From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dennis Hopper on Blue Velvet, Easy Rider, James Dean, Drugs, Paranoia, and his new movie, The Hot Spot. Also, artist William Wegman on photographing his two favorite models, his dogs, Man Ray and Fay Ray. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg questions whether Eskimos really have 100 different words to describe snow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. France's foreign minister called on world leaders today to find a way to protect Palestinians. His appeal follows the killing of 21 Palestinians on Monday by Israeli police. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas made the appeal during a speech to the French Parliament. He said the situation in Israel is extremely serious, and he urged the international community to work quickly towards finding a peaceful solution. While France maintains good relations with Jerusalem, the government has always been sympathetic towards the Palestinians. President Mitterrand has urged that an international conference be set up under the auspices of the United Nations to solve the Palestinian and other problems in the Middle East, including the Gulf crisis. In a clear reference to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, Roland Dumas warned that leaders would make a tragic error if they allowed those who are presently defying international law to exploit the Palestinian cause. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Central Council of the Palestine Liberation Organization met today in Tunis to consider stepping up activity against the Israeli rule in the occupied territories. The BBC's Peter Hyatt reports.
The killings in Jerusalem have brought about a marked hardening of the PLO's attitude towards the conduct of the uprising in the occupied territories, and senior Palestinians have been further angered by the American position so far in the United Nations Security Council talks on the killings. PLO sources now say that, as a result, the Central Council is likely to clear the way towards authorizing Palestinians in the occupied territories to use firearms. But this would not result in Palestinians immediately beginning to shoot Israelis. Instead, they say, the more likely procedure would be that the Council would mandate the PLO's Executive Committee to authorize, at the appropriate time, the use of firearms against military targets only. Nevertheless, this would represent an important escalation of the uprising, which until now the Palestinians have been carrying on mainly with stones.
The BBC's Peter Hyatt reporting from Tunisia. The U.S. Navy has called off a search for two helicopters missing over the Gulf of Oman. The Huey helicopters disappeared early Monday while conducting routine night operations from a Navy assault ship. Each of the aircraft had a crew of four Marines. Searchers reported seeing debris from the two helicopters, but no trace of any of the crew members. The eight deaths bring to 31 the number of people who've died in connection with Operation Desert Shield. Two U.S. airmen were killed today when their F-111 fighter plane crashed in southern Saudi Arabia. Prices on Wall Street were down sharply again today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 38 points to close at 2,407.92. Declines led advances by a margin of 4-1 in active trading of 168 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
All right. We're giving our neighbor a joyride. Let's get on with it. Anyone want to go on a joyride with us? How about you?
What a spectacular comeback Dennis Hopper made in Blue Velvet. He had screen presence to burn as the vile and sadistic Frank Booth. A few months later in River's Edge, Hopper played a burned-out hermit ex-biker whose only intimate relationship was with his inflatable doll. It confirmed that Hopper was brilliant at acting crazy. Just a few years before making these 1986 films, Hopper had been institutionalized, paranoid and totally disoriented from years of booze and drugs. Hopper made his film debut as a teenager with a small part in Rebel Without a Cause. In 1969, he became famous for directing, co-writing, and co-starring in the counterculture road movie Easy Rider. Now that Hopper is sober again, he's reestablished himself as a director as well as an actor. He made the 1988 film Colors about L.A. street gangs, and now he's directed the new film The Hotspot. It stars Don Johnson as an unscrupulous drifter who stops in a small Texas town. Orion Pictures wanted Hopper to direct this movie, so they sent him a script to look over.
I was given a script that was actually had been written by Mike Figgis from an original novel by Charles Williams. And I read it, and I thought that I could make an interesting movie out of it. When I gave it to my production manager to break it down, Paul Lewis, who's been with me since Easy Rider, he said, you know, it's weird. He said, I broke this down in 1962 for Robert Mitchum to play the lead in, and it was a much better script. And so it turned out that Charles Williams, the author of the novel, had actually written a script in 1962, which Mike Figgis had then, the director, had then taken and a few years ago had rewritten and changed the characters and made another. Anyway, I ended up doing the 1951-1962 from the novel screenplay by Charles Williams rather than the Mike Figgis thing.
How did you choose Don Johnson for the leading role? And I ask that because, you know, his reputation is mostly from television, and his two movies haven't really done that well.
Yeah. I thought that he was right for the part. I think it's certainly the best thing that he's ever done. I know it's the best thing he's ever done. And I edited it for over a year, and I can't, at this point, imagine anyone else doing it. Also, Orion wanted me to use a name person, and it satisfied their needs at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
He needs this picture very badly. I hope that this establishes him as a film entity, because he certainly needs it.
I want to ask you about the role that I think of as your comeback role, and I'm thinking of Blue Velvet and your role of Frank. I think it's so ironic in a way that you got Sane to play this role that's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, really.
You were reported as having told David Lynch when you accepted the role that you are Frank. How did you mean that, if in fact you said it?
Well, yeah, I did say it. I read the script. I meant that I really understood Frank. I didn't have a problem with Frank. I understood. I just understood him. And I called David. I'd never met David, and he'd given me the part, and I called him. He was down in North Carolina already. They'd begun filming. And I said, you don't have to worry about this. I am Frank. I really understand this role. So he got off the phone. He told Isabella and Kyle MacLachlan and Laura that, he said, my God, I just got off the phone with Dennis Hopper. And he said he was Frank. He said, that may be great for the movie, but how are we going to have lunch with him? But I really meant that I understood the role. And I do understand Frank. You know, I've known Frank. I've known a lot of guys like Frank.
Did you think that you were like Frank at some point in your life?
Well, I understood his sexual obsession, you know. And I, even though David wrote it as the stuff that he was sniffing as helium, I had always thought of it as some sort of drug, you know, like an amyl nitrate or a nitric oxide. And I asked David if it would be all right to play it that way. He had helium on the set, and all helium does, it doesn't disorient your mind. All it does is make you sound like Daffy Duck. So I tried it, and I said, David, I'm really aware. I'm just hearing my voice. I'm not, you know, able to act. I said, I want something. Couldn't I try to use something that, like, disoriented my mind? And he said, what? And I said, well, watch this. Like, I do a sense memory of an amyl nitrate, nitric oxide or something. He said, what are those things? I said, just watch. So anyway, he liked what he saw. And I said, if you want to dub that voice in the helium voice in later, we could do that. And he said, no, I don't think it'll be necessary. Anyway, we didn't dub it in later, and it did work. But, you know, since then, I started thinking how strange it would be if I'd used that helium voice and not had it disorient my mind. What a strange character he had actually written, even more stranger than my portrayal of Frank.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
You know, it'd just been this guy who takes this, that does this mask and gets this weird voice and then does all those things and nothing else happens to him. It'd be very bizarre. But anyway, because when I read it, I thought of it that way, of the drug kind of drug-crazed guy and the sexual kind of strange appetite that he had. I could identify with those things.
Do you like roles with the kind of intensity that your performance has in the character of Frank?
Well, like, you know, I think that probably of all the work that I've done, Frank is probably the flashiest role I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like it on that level. Yeah.
Dennis Hopper is my guest. You grew up on a farm. Were you anxious to get away when you were growing up?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to know where the trains were going. I had a wonderful childhood, though. My mother ran a swimming pool in Dodge City, Kansas, and I lived with my grandparents. My father was at war in the Second World War, and I lived with my grandparents on a small farm, and then my grandfather worked on a larger farm in Garden City, Kansas, and a wheat farm that I would go out and work on during the summer. And I had a wonderful childhood on that level.
Your mother was very religious. She was a fundamentalist?
I don't know where that sort of started. My mother is religious, yeah.
What was your attitude about God?
When I was younger, she wasn't as religious as she became later in my life. I wasn't raised under any great pressure as her being a fundamentalist when I was a young kid. So that's sort of gotten distorted.
So there wasn't,
religious pressures?
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I could wear lipstick and I could dress as a girl anytime I wanted to. Is that what you mean? Things like that? Yeah, and I was allowed to dance on the table and so on. No, I
took the words out of my mouth.
Thanks, yeah. Wait till I put this lipstick on, will you? No.
Yeah.
I didn't have those kind of pressures. I went to Sunday school and things like that, but I didn't have a lot of pressures in those ways. When I first saw my first movies when I was a kid, they really affected me, and I wanted to know how they were made. And I'm not sure that that's uncommon for any kid who first sees his films or first sees television or whatever.
When you were young, you got a scholarship to the National Shakespeare Festival. Did you want to do classical theater?
I did it, and I wanted to do it. I wanted to become a great actor, and at that time, the great actors were Shakespearean actors, the ones that were thought of in the theater. I wasn't able to get into movies, so in the theater were classical actors. So I got involved in classical theater, Shakespeare.
Your first movie role was in Rebel Without a Cause. You were, I think, 18 years old. Did the movie help give you a sense of teenagers being their own culture and their own misunderstood culture? Were you already feeling that way?
When I went on that picture, I saw James Dean for the first time act, and at that point, all I was concerned about was being an actor. I wasn't concerned about, like, you know, whether people were juvenile delinquents or not. I had sort of come out of that, out of San Diego and Tijuana and that kind of area, but I was interested in acting, and I saw James Dean act, and I basically, through Rebel Without a Cause, I was just trying to figure out what he was doing, because I thought I was the best young actor at that time in the world, and I suddenly ran into this guy who was some years older than me, but he was doing work that I was so far over my head, I actually grabbed him on the chicky run and threw him into a car and said, "What are you doing? You got to teach me what you're doing."
So what did he teach you?
He wanted to know what my motivation was for wanting to act. Yeah. And he asked me if I'd had a problem with my parents, that if I had actually hated my parents, and that that was part of the drive that I had to want to become an actor. And I said that actually I had felt that. And he said, well, that's what he felt also, and that his mother died when he was very young, and he used to go to her grave and cry on her grave and say, "Mother, why have you left me? Why have you left me?" And that turned into, "I'm going to show you, I'm going to show you, I'm going to be someone." And that was the drive that he had brought into his acting, which I described the same sort of feelings that I was misunderstood by my parents, and that I had that feeling when they came to the theater that I was going to show them. And it was like, you know, "I'm going to show you, I'm going to be something, I'm going to be an actor. So these, this drive, this confused kind of drive and wanting to put it into other people's other parts and other things, and these feelings, to use them in some sort of imaginary given circumstance, became the key for acting. But anyway, he said you must learn how to not worry about the emotions, but you must learn how to do things and not show them. You must learn how to smoke a cigarette and just not act smoking the cigarette. You must learn how to drink a drink, not act drinking the drink. And if somebody knocks on the door, you go and answer the door. Then you see they have a gun in their hand. Then you react to the gun and so on. So basically, it's like don't indicate, but like do something and don't show it. And moment-to-moment reality. Never anticipate what the next moment's going to hold. And so, like, you know, he said, then, you know, you're a very good technical actor, so get rid of all that technique, though. Stop the line readings. Don't worry about how it's going to come out. Just let it come out. Work on a moment-to-moment reality level.
Stop the line readings. What did you stop doing?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I was out of a classical theater background, so, I mean, there were ways of reading lines, you know. I mean, even hello, how are you became a way of reading a line. So there's a lot of ways to say hello, how are you, besides one fixed way that you decide in your room somewhere that that's the way you're going to say hello, how are you.
Was James Dean the first friend that you had who died? Like someone of around your age.
Yeah, I mean, there had been, I would think, yeah.
Did it scare you a lot to have someone who
well,
was close
it was more,
to you?
I mean, more than a friend, I think of him more as a teacher than as a friend. We did two films together, which took about a year of our lives. He only made three movies. We did Rebel Without a Cause and then Giant. And then he died 2 weeks before we finished shooting Giant. So I was like 19, he was 24. It was more, we dealt with acting. We talked about acting. It wasn't like we went out and drank beers together and got high or like race cars or anything. When he died, it just destroyed me because I totally had this belief in destiny and how people are destined, you know, to be, to fulfill their destiny, you know, and I just couldn't understand why James Dean had died so young. He wanted to direct movies. He had only been in three movies, and it just destroyed my whole concept of destiny, life, and that kind of thing for years. I mean, probably still, till this day, it still bothers me. I miss him. I wish I'd have seen his work.
Dennis Hopper is my guest. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
And Dennis Hopper's directed a new movie, and it's called The Hot Spot. It stars Don Johnson, and we'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor and director Dennis Hopper is my guest, and he directed a new movie called The Hot Spot. I have to ask you about Easy Rider, the 1969 film that you co-wrote, directed, and starred in. You had done some work with Roger Corman. Peter Fonda had done some biker-type movies and acid trip movies with Corman. Did you see this as an exploitation film, or did you want it to be a movie in the spirit of the counterculture?
You're talking about Easy Rider?
Easy Rider, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't really thinking about either one of those things. I wanted to win the Cannes Film Festival. I wanted it to be an art film.
Right.
The counterculture was becoming the culture at that time. So I thought I was making a film for everyone. What I did was I showed people smoking marijuana without going out and killing a bunch of nurses for the first time. And I used the music of the day as a time capsule kind of thing rather than writing a score for a movie. It was the first time individual songs had been used for a film. The editing of the cemetery sequence was like a lot of, like, you know, experimental films that I'd seen of the day. Bruce Conner in particular, I'd used a lot of like kind of cutting that I'd seen on television for television commercials. We now look at MTV, but if you realize that those rides that I edited to the music, to Jimi Hendrix and to the Byrds and to Dylan and so on, those were the first MTV kind of things, music video kind of things that were ever done.
Were you already doing a lot of drugs when you made Easy Rider, and was that out of control at all?
There was a lot of smoking of grass on that picture. Grass made me paranoid, and I didn't do it. I mean, I would do it. I did it, like, for the scene where Peter and Jack and I are all smoking marijuana, and we see the space people, or Jack talks about space people and so on. But most of the time, I didn't smoke it, only because it made me paranoid. But I drank. I was a drinker. I was a classic drinker in the great tradition of John Huston, Howard Hawks, John Ford, and Dennis Hopper. Now, I was an alcoholic, and I was never a big pot smoker, even though I smoked pot a great deal in my life. I didn't do it while I worked.
What were your paranoid fantasies that it would bring out? Or what form of paranoia would it bring out in you?
Well, it would interfere with the work, and nothing that I did that interfered with the work. The work was the only thing that was important to me. People like came to Paul Lewis and I a few years ago. Paul was also the production manager on Easy Rider, and all the films that I've made, he's been with me, the last movie and so on. And so people came and said, how could you have done the last movie doing all that cocaine and so on? We didn't have any cocaine on Easy Rider. We just made it popular. That was baking soda that I chose to use in Easy Rider. But anyway, I went to Peru and I made a movie called The Last Movie, which I won the Venice Film Festival with, which was never distributed. It's a long story. But we used a lot of cocaine on that movie. And people said, how could you make a movie and drink and use cocaine and smoke grass and so on? And Paul said, are you serious? We were making movies. You know, it wasn't anything. If somebody had said, you can't have any drugs, you have to make the movie, we'd have made the movie. Nobody said you can't have any drugs. And we weren't doing anything that interfered with what we thought was our work. So, like, you know, it was always the work. The work was the most important thing. And the drugs and the alcohol and all those things are secondary to it. And we never, and I always measured it out. You know, if I was getting too drunk, I'd do a little more cocaine, you know, and keep the work going. So, like, you know, anyway, that wasn't...
So how did it get to the point where you did so much drugs that you ended up not working?
Well, I mean, there comes a point where, like, you know, if you're not the most popular guy in the world and in demand, suddenly people start looking at your behavior and not wanting to work with you. There are certain people that we don't have to name, but there's some very, very big people that, like, it never interfered with their popularity, and it never interfered with their careers, and some of our biggest stars. So, you know, and I'm not advising people to use drugs or not to use drugs. Drugs destroyed my life, but I probably would never have found out about it and never gotten straight and never gotten into the trouble that I got into with drugs and alcohol if my career had maintained a level where I was productive.
I get the impression that you've been working really manically since you've been straight.
Mm-hmm. I would have worked manically all my life if I'd have been allowed to.
I mean, if you got offered enough?
Yeah, I was never offered anything. So at a certain point, my using and my drinking became who's coming out of the dressing room, Jekyll or Hyde. What emotional roller coaster is he going to take us on now? So, you know, that's what, unfortunately, drugs and alcohol did for me in my life, and my personal life was a shambles. It never seemed to hurt what went on the screen, but it was the process to getting it on the screen that terrified people.
Dennis Hopper is my guest, and he has a new movie now called The Hot Spot. It stars Don Johnson. There's a kind of, I think, pretty famous story about what happened, an incident that happened in your early career. And you were working on a movie that Henry Hathaway was directing, and he was trying to get you to do the scene the way he wanted to. You had your own way of wanting to do it. And I think this went on for like 12 hours or something of you doing takes and him insisting that you do it his way.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finally won.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of your rebelliousness that you were pretty much exiled from Hollywood for a while. Is that
yeah,
right?
For a long time. Till he rehired me again.
Till he rehired you again.
Yeah, 7 or 8 years later.
So did you end up doing a lot of TV in that period?
Yeah.
I recently saw you on The Rifleman. I think it was the first episode.
Right. You know, Sam Peckinpah wrote the pilot of The Rifleman, which I did.
It was the pilot I saw.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, you know, now that you're directing again, if you ever see yourself in the Henry Hathaway role of really wanting the actor to do it your way.
I don't see myself any other way.
You mean you see...
Did I hear a pause?
Yeah. So
did you hear a pin drop?
I'm
the director, so I want them to do it my way.
So if you saw the young Dennis Hopper coming in and he insisted on doing it his way, what would have happened?
I would have probably been amazed by the young Dennis Hopper and let him do it his way. But I would have never let him know that he was doing it. I mean, I would have given him plenty of space to do it his way. Hathaway didn't. But if it comes down to doing it my way, I mean, it's got to be my way. But, like, I give actors a lot of room to work. I mean, I never had a problem with Sean Penn. I never had a problem with Robert Duvall. I had problems with Don Johnson. But I don't have problems seeing what I got on the screen with Don Johnson because we worked it out and he did it my way.
What kind of problems did you have with
him? Well, I just found him, not a steady actor, you know, at times, you know, and like that we had to work really hard to get him to like be real, to do things real and so on. And we did work hard and Don worked very hard on this, and it's a great performance by Don. He's never been better than he is in the hot spot. The director is the boss, and that's just the way it is. So Hathaway, I learned that from Hathaway. Also, I learned a lot of things from Hathaway. I did 3 films for Hathaway. He was the boss, and the director is the boss. And if you're in a director's movie and you don't do what the director wants you to do, you might as well, it doesn't matter how good you are, you look like you're out of step with everybody else, and you might as well just hang it up right there because it's no sense fighting him.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dennis Hopper, and he has a new film. He directed it. It's called The Hot Spot. It stars Don Johnson and Virginia Madsen. It opens in 5 cities this Friday and in the rest of the country on October 26th. Next time, Jane Goodall. She's studied and lived among the chimpanzees of East Africa for the past 30 years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The art world lost one of its greatest models in 1982, a blue-gray short-haired hound named Man Ray. For over 10 years, artist and photographer William Wegman immortalized his pet dog, wrapping him in yards of tinsel and posing him in the manner of classic paintings. Coming up, Wegman tells us about his most famous collaboration with Man Ray and his current partnership with another pet dog named Fay Ray. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg challenges some common wisdom about language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, a U.S. resolution condemning excessive use of force by Israel is still under discussion at the U.N., where some countries are calling for stronger measures. NPR's Ann Garrels has more on the story.
The United States has put forward a resolution specifically condemning the killing of at least 21 Arabs in Monday's clash in Jerusalem. By taking this action, the first U.S. condemnation of Israel since 1982, the U.S. hoped to assuage Arab concerns. But the non-aligned countries led by Yemen and supported by other Arabs and the PLO are demanding an investigation of the current situation and ways to protect Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. The U.S. objects to this sweeping U.N. role because, according to U.S. Ambassador Pickering, it won't work. Israel has made it clear it will not permit such a U.N. commission. The debate, which began yesterday, could go on until tomorrow. I'm Ann Garrels at the United Nations in New York.
An Air Force jet has crashed in Saudi Arabia, killing both U.S. servicemen on board. The jet fighter was the fourth U.S. military airplane involved in accidents in the Gulf area since military forces were sent there after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. In all, 24 U.S. servicemen have died since deployment. Eight others are missing and presumed dead. On Capitol Hill, the House Ways and Means Committee has approved a deficit reduction plan that makes smaller cuts in Medicare and gasoline taxes than was proposed by the bipartisan budget summit. And as NPR's Mara Liasson reports, those working on a budget plan are working against a deadline.
In just 9 days, dozens of congressional committees working in full view of the public must come up with a product that a small group of budget summit negotiators, working in private, were unable to achieve in months. Today, the key panel in the House of Representatives, the Ways and Means Committee, rewrote the budget summit agreement, the package that was rejected by Congress. The Ways and Means Committee did away with the summit agreement's most unpopular aspects. Medicare beneficiaries will pay more for benefits, but not as much more as in the budget summit agreement. And a two-week wait for unemployment benefits will also be eliminated. To make up for the revenue these provisions lose, the Ways and Means Committee eliminated tax incentives for small businesses and other tax breaks. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
And the space shuttle Discovery came back to Earth this morning with what was called a picture-perfect touchdown at Edwards Air Force Base in California. The five astronauts on board Discovery closed out a four-day mission, during which they launched a space probe that is to fly to the sun and study the uncharted poles of the sun. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 38 points to close at 2,407.92, volume 168 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 4-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. This is the story of an artist and his dog, or dogs. William Wegman is a photographer, video artist, and painter who is best known for his pictures of his pet dog, Man Ray, named, of course, after the artist Man Ray. The dog Man Ray has been immortalized in Wegman's photographs, disguised as a dinosaur, wrapped in yarn, in a classic profile, and in dozens of other inventive poses. Man Ray died in 1982, and for the past few years, Wegman has been working with his pet dog, Fay Ray. Wegman's work comments on classic art and contemporary popular culture. His art has been shown in museums around the world. There's a new retrospective book of his work published by Abrams. I asked William Wegman if he bought his pet dog, Man Ray, with the idea of using him as a model.
Not really. He did enter in quite quickly because I'd just started to do photography. And like getting the new puppy and the new camera. I actually just moved to California from Wisconsin.
So what was the first time you used the dog?
Probably the first day I got him, when he was 7 weeks old in Long Beach, California in 1970.
And what was the photograph?
The photograph was a sock and a dog on the bed, and they both looked alike. So I first photographed him just just as another thing around the house. And since he was sleeping so much, I'd plant things on him, for instance, alligators and stuffed squirrels, just props, things like that.
Did you ever wish that Man Ray could have looked at the art and really appreciated what was happening in it and how he was being used?
I really do think of him as a collaborator with me. I know that he was really aware that we were making things, not maybe that first month, but soon afterwards. He knew that we were going here to do photographs or videotapes, and that it wasn't just like playing ball or going to the beach.
When you started doing your photography and using your dog Man Ray in the pictures, this was a period when a lot of artists were beginning to use themselves as art and themselves as the subject of their art. Did you see yourself as using Man Ray instead of yourself during that period?
Well, I couldn't really afford assistance at the time, so I used myself and things around the house. And one of the troubling things about using yourself is, first of all, you don't really have a kind of distance to see what you look like. And it's kind of obnoxious, I think, after a while to be putting yourself on television. Using the dog really helped to work around that basic complaint of mine.
Do you think you went through different Man Ray periods?
Definitely.
Yeah, what are the different periods?
Well, we had a blue period that lasted one day. I guess the first pictures he was used more as a space modulator. His pointing abilities and just standing still. And in the later period, he was more of a character actor as he lost his great figure. I started to cover him up. And
you also have posed him in some very classical poses and settings.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, I know that I was rather schizophrenic about how I thought of him. I wanted to keep him very noble, but I wanted to do these other things too. And I think when I turned him into a frog, he still somehow got some nobility behind that, other than when he's like this Indian chief in a canoe, which
yeah,
is rather...
Right.
It's powerful.
It's a very kind of classic American painting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he the dog's in a canoe, and there's mountains behind him, and the sky is kind of overcast, and he has a very noble look on his face, and he's wearing an Indian headdress.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that might be one of the last photographs, that I might just send him off into that body of water without a paddle and then drive back to New York. It was near the end.
Oh, this was 1981. Was he sick then?
Well, he died in 81 or 82, so about 8 months after that. And towards the end of his life, I did think that each one might be the last series of collaborations. The very last pictures are rather touching and rather personal, too. They're the close-up portraits, the big heads, you might say. Some project a kind of posthumous look to them where he looks like a Roman coin, like Julius Caesar or maybe JFK. Other times he looks... Like an old worn out pet, and rather deeply human or deeply canine, I guess.
Were you ever worried that your sense of humor and playfulness with how you used Man Ray would be seen as too frivolous in the art world?
That's a huge question, and not a very funny one. But it's some people when I first moved to New York said to me quite. Immediately, I hate humor in art, and in a way, I agree with them. I don't like humor in art either. It's generally pointed out to be something rather trite, and I remember teachers pointing to Paul Klee and like the twittering machines as being examples of humor in art, and Alexander Calder. I think both are very fine artists, but they're not really funny like, say... a really great comic is funny. So the parallels of art and humor were a little suspect, I think.
Well, do you think of your work as having humor in it?
I think it's pretty hilarious half the time. One of my art dealers said, some of your work is funny and some of it is not so funny. And I think that's true. I mean, if it was funny, I didn't rule it out. And if it was not funny, I didn't rule it out because that wasn't the only thing going for it.
Well, you've even had some of your work shown on the David Letterman show.
Mm-hmm.
What did that do to your prices? I'm really curious about that. Did they go up or what?
I don't think Letterman had much to do with that. I think that the early Saturday Night Live people
oh, sure,
I was working
right.
with them. And I think that was an era where it was very exciting for artists to work, to get beyond and outside the gallery or museum or the usual art situations. It was really exciting until we achieved that, and then it was just another thing. So right now it seems to be just another thing, but in the early 70s it was a new frontier.
Was there a period in the late 60s or early 70s where you felt a lot of artists were taking themselves too seriously?
I think especially in video that became a problem because it was hard to, no one was telling you when to turn it off, you know, just okay, enough. When you're on real TV, you have a producer and a director saying you're off the air or stop, but a lot of performance and video artists in the early 70s just let the machine go on too long, I think, and I hope I was really careful about that, or I was very sensitive about that.
After your dog Man Ray died, you later got another dog, a female of the same breed,
mm-hmm.
And you named her Fay Ray, and you've been using her in photographs since. Did you feel guilty at first, like you would be perceived as trying to replace Man Ray, who you were so close to?
I didn't get another dog that I worked with for 4 years after Man Ray, so it wasn't the day afterwards. And I didn't work with Fay for one whole year because I didn't want to do that. I was especially careful not to do that. I really thought it was over. But one day I just decided to see what it felt like. And it felt great. It felt like I was really denying myself a basic pleasure and right, and that's to photograph a dog. Suddenly I realized who I was for a moment. And since then, I've photographed Fay many more times than Ray, and I've only had her 6 years. And Ray, of course, I had 12.
It seems to me you're really working with the gender differences between Man Ray and Fay Ray. You know, there's one shot of Fay Ray where she has her claws painted with red Revlon nail polish, and you've got her posed in gowns and exotic clothes.
There's a slight misunderstanding here. There was a piece called Fay Ray where I painted Man Ray's toenails red.
Oh.
But that's
well, you are gender bending.
But yes, Fay is also much, she's got a whole different shape than Man Ray. I really used Man Ray at the Polaroid studio with those large format pictures when he was 9 years old. And, of course, Fay was 1 year old when I first brought her there. So I was using a young, very thoroughbred-looking, healthy dog as opposed to an aging character actor to the studio.
You know, now that I mention it, I'm remembering that the Fay Ray, where it's a Man Ray who's posed and his claws are painted red, it's actually F-E-Y because, you know, he's Fay with the nail polish on.
That's
so
right.
I forgot about that little pun in there. I should have remembered that.
That was, in fact, the first color Polaroid I took of Man Ray, and I had never used color before, so I used it in a very self-conscious way as a black background with a gray dog and just the smallest amount of red introduced in a literal way.
Well, let me get back to the subject of gender, mm-hmm. and posing your dogs. Do you feel like you're using their gender differently?
Oh, I definitely am. And I'm also using what I mentioned before is their age differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of having had Man Ray pass away of their mortality. So I know that a 1986 picture when Fay was very young, can never be redone again. And that was when she had maximum flexibility. And I think right now she's looking even more feminine, but in a matriarchal way, because she had a litter of puppies. And she's filled out. She looks like a wonderful wild animal and a mother at the same time. This is a strange combination.
Artist William Wegman is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Artist William Wegman is my guest. A few years ago, back in 1985, you started painting again.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you give up painting in the first place?
Well, when the 60s painting was dead, you wouldn't be caught doing it. If you were making a painting, you would call it a wall piece. So I didn't want to be caught dead doing that. It was just not really there. As a young, arrogant grad student, I gave up painting in 1966 and went on to do, after wall pieces, I did floor pieces, outdoor pieces, and floating things down the river pieces, and then finally video and photography. So that was my route there.
Well, did you ever have the impulse to paint, even though it wasn't maybe so hip at the time to be doing it?
Well, I think actually when I started painting again in 85, it was more as though the type of paintings that I was doing right before I went to art school as a juvenile or as a, my 10 and 12-year-old paintings of cowboys and Indians and pirate scenes. So I was kind of skipped art education to pick up where I left off at age 12.
When you started painting again, did you feel like you had any technique left? Did you feel like you remembered how to paint?
Oh, I did in a way, but in retrospect, I didn't really. I mean, my first paintings I did, I said, hey, these are great. I really know how to do this. But by next year, I realized that I didn't. So I kind of marched through my techniques pretty quickly.
What got you involved in art in the first place?
I think I just ruled out every other thing by having such bad grades in high school, and I needed an A, and I took art. And my art teacher said, you're really talented, you should go to art school. And so I did, and it kind of really changed my life. Art was really important to me as a child, but as a teenager, I was more interested in sports, and didn't see myself going to Canada to play hockey for the Canadiens, so... I took up art instead without knowing really what it was.
When your teacher told you that you were really talented, what did that mean, that you could draw a realistic-looking face or a realistic-looking street scene?
Well, probably. I can't remember exactly what I was doing, but it was probably some sort of landscape drawings and paintings. Mm-hmm. And I always did watercolors based on scenes outside my window in Western Massachusetts or... pouring through the World Book Encyclopedia, which is pretty much still my source for my paintings right now.
How are you using it now?
I just kind of browse through my 1950s World Books and find images, which I just kind of shop for images. Trains, planes, mining scenes, turnpikes, Just look through any of those encyclopedias and you'll see my paintings. But or you can go to a gallery and see them.
While we're on the subject of your images, there's one image I really want to ask you about in one of your paintings. There's two, I don't know if they're apartment buildings, but they're two several-story high buildings, like maybe 20 stories or something. And each building is separated by a few inches. And this is from the perspective of looking down at the roof. And on one roof... there's a man with a camera. Mm-hmm. And on the other roof, there appears to be two people. This is all very kind of through a haze. You know, there's two people holding up third person by their arms and kind of dangling them over the edge of the roof.
Well, I saw that as a family photography session where the mother is dangling her daughter between the skyscraper and the father is taking the photograph of the child. And I didn't put in the expression, but you can assume some sort of terror look on the child's face. So it's a kind of a family how-to in photography. How to get good expressions from your children, I guess, in photography. So it is rather a sinister subject, I think.
Gee, what are you saying about photography in there?
Well, I love those books on how-to in photography, these helpful tips. So it's just taking it to some absurd place, which is... But a lot of my own photographs tend to do, and drawings especially. They take a very logical scene. Like, I think I actually just did pluck that family group off the ground. You know, it said showed the mother tossing the child around, and instead I just relocated over between two skyscrapers, like the World Trade Center.
Some of your photographic work is with these large format Polaroids that are... how large are they?
They're 20 by 24 inches.
Mm-hmm. What are the advantages for you of working that big, working on that scale?
One advantage is just it's a standard size that I don't have to reconsider afterwards. It always comes out that size.
Mm-hmm.
It's instant. In other words, in about 70 seconds, I see what I've done on the scale that I'm going to be ultimately showing it at. So it's not a process. It's just there. And I can say, it's not there, and we have to do this, or it's there, and I can do something else.
Does it also provide instant gratification because of that?
Well, instant knowledge is what it is,
right,
to know that you're done and you can go on. And with my other photography, I use a Hasselblad 2.25 format. I have to wait a day to get the film back to know if I had it done, and by then I may not continue with it, or I may.
Right. I want to get back to your early pictures and then going to art school. I mean, your early paintings were pictures,
mm-hmm.
you know. Then you went to art school and you gave up on painting. I'm thinking about what it must have been like to turn your back on the form that got you into art in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I think things move very quickly when you're young. When you're 19, you learn something, and by 20, you've learned that it's embarrassing and passé, and by 22, you're on to something even more urgent and tremendously important. But by the time you're 40, things have a whole different pattern to them. So I was racing through art movements in my young years to establish my own credentials, to find something that was my own. And I guess I was, along with everybody else in the 60s, turning things upside down and finding new this and different that's, you know, to arrive somewhere that hadn't been so trodden over.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your art.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
William Wegman, a retrospective exhibition of his work, is currently touring Europe. It comes to the U.S. in 1991. A book of Wegman's work has just been published by Abrams. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Report tonight that Israel is taking action to investigate the police shootings of Palestinians on the Temple Mount on Monday. Robert Siegel talks with Republican Senator William Armstrong, who's not happy with the budget compromise now being talked about on Capitol Hill. He says there could be a continuing resolution for as long as 1 year's time to come up with a real budget. Unidentified Flying Objects Out There, that's the title of a book by Howard Bloom, who says there is a working group within the Defense Department to ascertain the validity of UFO sightings. And the new study about coffee says it's not so bad to drink.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says it's not how many words a culture has for a particular thing that defines the subtleties of that culture's expression, but how well those words are used.
A recent editorial in the New York Times mentioned the 100 Eskimo words for snow. Shortly after that, there was an item in the same newspaper's science section that put the figure at 48. I suppose the specific number doesn't really matter. Everybody knows there are a lot of them. Well, actually, the Standard Dictionary of West Greenlandic Eskimo lists exactly two roots for snow, konik, which means snow in the air, and aput, which means snow on the ground. This is no big deal. It's like our distinction between rain and water. Other varieties of Eskimo may have a few more roots than this, but no more than English does with our snow, sleet, and slush. It's true that either language lets you make as many distinctions as you like. You can talk about wet snow, dry snow, packed snow, or the snows of yesteryear. But you don't need separate words to do it with. I owe this revelation to a couple of recent papers by the anthropologist Laura Martin and the linguist Jeff Pullum. They've been waging a lonely crusade to put the kibosh on the great Eskimo snow job. Martin has traced the story back to a misinterpretation of a casual remark by the turn-of-the-century anthropologist Franz Boas. Somehow, the idea caught the public fancy and entered the great amorphous body of linguistic folklore. Probably part of the appeal of the story is that we'll believe just about anything about Eskimos. They rub noses, lend their wives to strangers, leave their old people out to freeze. Certainly, it would be hard to get away with telling this kind of tale about a less exotic people, that the French have 13 words for cuckold, or that the Anglo-Saxons had 21 different ways of saying disembowel. But I suspect the real reason people like this story is for what it's supposed to prove about language. The more words you have for something, the more subtleties you're capable of, and the finer your perception. So we set our students to improving their word power with vocabulary lists, and we confidently explain that English is superior to all other languages because it is supposed to have more words than they do. Of course, a specialized vocabulary can be useful. Decorators and designers know a lot more different color words than most people do, and they don't mind your knowing it. I asked the salesman at Macy's, "How much are those brown trousers on the counter?" He looked at me as if he were considering a mustard stain on his herringbone and said, "Oh, you mean the taupe." But distinctions are not necessarily a good thing to have. You can lose sight of the big picture. For example, English has a remarkably large number of words to describe physical beauty. Things can be beautiful, pretty, gorgeous, lovely, attractive, handsome, cute, and so on. Whereas Italian does the same work with just one word, bello, sometimes with a little help from a suffix, as in bellino or bellissimo. So we should pity the poor Italians, whose language doesn't allow them to make all the subtle aesthetic distinctions that English is capable of. Except that then you look at their paintings and sports jackets and compare them to our paintings and sports jackets, and you realize that something is terribly wrong with this theory. The crucial thing about language isn't its power to make distinctions, but its power to generalize. Nature comes at us in an infinity of different categories, and we need words to fold them together. What's remarkable is not that a language has many words for snow, as that English makes do with so few. Think of it, a crusted meadow under the distant glitter of a January sun, flakes swirling in the cone of a street lamp, the sooty heaps along West End Avenue dotted with dog turds, all comprehended in a single syllable.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Roberta Shurrock and Mary Van Voorst. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jane Goodall discusses her 30 years studying and living among the wild chimpanzees of Tanzania. Also, actor Paul Winfield. He plays the judge in Presumed Innocent. That and more on the next Fresh Air.